Good day, friends, and welcome to the Hashtag Music Ed Love Lecture Series. We are thrilled to see so many of you here at the University of Tennessee at Martin and can't wait to reach many more of you on our podcast. Today is our extreme pleasure to welcome Dr. Eric Branscombe. Dr. Branscombe is very happy to be visiting UTM today to speak with you all. Eric Branscombe is the Chair of Music Department at Austin Peay State University, teaches undergraduate and graduate courses in music education, supervises music education teachers or students, and is the founder and director of Camp Granada, APSU's elementary music summer music program. He is the recipient of the 2012 Socrates Award for Excellence in Teaching, the 2014 Harold Love Community Service Award, and the 2016 Outstanding Advising Award. Prior to his appointment at APSU, Dr. Branscombe taught courses in music education and instrumental music at East Texas Baptist University, Dallas Baptist University, and was a teaching fellow at the University of North Texas. Dr. Branscombe also taught preschool and elementary music for 7 years in Miami and in the Dallas area, where he directed various elementary choirs, instrumental ensembles, and founded Camp Granada. Welcome, Dr. Branscombe.
How are you all doing?
Good.
Good. There's my whole speech. So we're going to be here for a really short amount of time, which is wonderful. So I heard that a lot of you have spent the last week being interviewed for part of your How to Be a Teacher program. Some of you are not there yet in your program, so in a couple semesters you'll be going through that interview process, and some of you have already been through that process, and you're on the downhill side of things. Yes?
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. There are two main points that I want to make tonight, two major things I want to talk about, which is why my little sheet of paper is so short. The first is actually a list of two or three points that all come together under one meta point, one big something or other, that then relates to the next thing. And all of this comes down to the gestalt of how all these little tiny things impact the one big thing. And I want to talk to you a lot today about career paths, ending with some job interview types of questions. For those of you who were here a couple weeks ago, Dr. Michael Chandler was here from Austin Peay. He talked to you about some job interview skills, yes? So I'll follow up with some job interview questions, because that to me is one of the most important, you can call it a hurdle. For some people it's a stumbling block. For some people it's the launching point that actually gets you the job. And that's the thing that serves as the main transition from your life as a student to your life as a teacher, is how to successfully navigate those interviews. But before you get to that point, there are a couple things that are so much more important than just the interview. Because the interview is so much more than just how well you answer those questions right there on the spot. There are things that you can and should be doing all along the way that provide the ammunition for you to answer these questions that are here in the interview. And a lot of the times when they ask questions on the interview, they don't really care what you say. They just want to see how well you say it. They want to hear how well you are convinced of your own answer. They want to hear the underlying premise of what did you just say and why did you just say that. But the trick is what it takes to get to that interview process. And there are several different things that I've learned along the way that have really helped shape the way I answer certain interview questions. They've really helped shape who I am as a teacher. And there are things that I want to try to pass along to you all. And one of the things we were just talking about over dinner is that life has a way of changing your plans for you. And when that happens, my favorite quote is, "Congratulations, you're normal." One of my favorite quotes, I find that I say that a lot. And so there are a couple things I want to begin with before we get to the job interview questions. And the first one is the word bridges. Say it.
Bridges.
Bridges. Build bridges. This is not bridges as in cry a river, build a bridge, and get over it. Not that kind of bridge. But instead, you will be amazed at the bridges in your life, the professional bridges, the things, the people connections that will lead to you getting a job or not. Did you get that last part of that? So it's been my experience, and I'm going to explain this in more detail in a bit, that the people in this room are the most incredibly important people in your lives right now, and you never know who sitting in the room right now may eventually impact your ability to get a job later. The people who are your teachers now might be your principals later, or you might try to hire them later because you'll be on the other side of the interview table. Bridges are incredibly important. I'll illustrate that in a second. The second thing, I love this quote, you never know when you might be expected to know something. You never know when you might be expected to know something. Have you ever seen the poor Miss America contestant YouTube? They ask her about maps. And she was clearly not ready for that question. When we're done here tonight, I want you to YouTube. I think it's 2007 and she's Miss South Carolina. And in her defense, she was supposedly a really intelligent young woman, just not ready for that question. And she just lost it. She was not ready for that question. You never know when you might be expected to know something. So that's point number two. What was point number one?
Bridges.
Bridges. Number two is you never know when you might be expected to know what?
Something.
Anything. And the third one, I always call it this way, Chinese food. Chinese food. We just got back from Chinese food. I call it Chinese food. How do you know if you like Chinese food? You got to try it. So let me ask you this. First time you're going to try Chinese food, you're going to drive to Memphis or drive to Nashville, find the most expensive Chinese food restaurant in the state, order the biggest, most expensive plate of something. Right? No. Please, God, no. Don't do that. How are you going to try Chinese food the first time? You're going to sit there next to someone who's got something and you say, can I try that? Because if you don't like it, you've not wasted any money. And no harm, no foul. But you learn if you like Chinese food, right? Now, what if you just try that one thing, that sweet and sour chicken? I don't like Chinese food based on sweet and sour chicken. Is that fair? No, you need to try a little bit of everything of the Chinese food to figure out if you'd like Chinese food or if you just don't like that particular part of Chinese food. Why in the world am I rambling about that? As a college-level music education person, and now as the department chair, I get a whole lot of people coming to college and they utter the most dangerous words on the planet. I think I wanna. I think I wanna be a music teacher. I think I wanna perform. Dangerous words. Because I think I wanna implies you don't really know. You're about to try to be a music teacher. You're about to try Chinese food. And you're gonna try to be a music teacher by making about a $20,000 or $40,000 investment. You're coming to college having never taught before, having never stood in front of students before, having never tried anything along the lines of music education, and you're saying, I want to be a band director or a choir director or orchestra director. Have you tried it before? No. So, Chinese food. To know whether or not you want more Chinese food, you got to try it. To really know whether or not you're going to be a good teacher, you need to shut your ears. You need to get out of the classroom. You need to get into a school. And you need to try it. Let's say that you spend 5 minutes in a preschool music classroom and you hate it. I am not going to be a music teacher. You just tried that one little tiny dish of Chinese food and you put the whole field into one little box. So try a little preschool music. Try a little middle school music and then go to therapy because middle schoolers. But then try some high school music. Try all different kinds to figure out where you are the best fit. And that word fit is one of the most important aspects of trying this all on. You might love this, hate that. I discovered, I'll tell you more in detail later, which age group is my favorite age group versus, holy cow, please don't ever ask me to do that. Oh my goodness. How many of you have experienced multiple ages of students? And you, good, yay. And you're finding which area you like best and which area, just, please don't make me get that job. Good, 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 good. So in all of that, the last little quote of this, what was the first one?
Bridges.
Bridges. Number two? Number three? Chinese food. Number four, it's a Yiddish proverb, man plans, God laughs. You ever see Bruce Almighty? There's a little subtle tribute to this little quote in that movie, and it's only a funny scene in the movie if you know the quote. Jim Carrey's character is complaining about all these plans he's made and nothing's ever working. And as he's doing that, Morgan Freeman's character, he's playing the part of God, he just bursts out laughing. So if you know that little Yiddish proverb, you know why he's laughing. And, oh, that's funny now. Ha, ha. So man plans, God laughs. Which means you're going to have your career paths in mind, and please set goals. But when those goals change, don't be surprised. Man plans, God laughs. I think, based on my experiences anyway, there are three types of people that come to college. As I describe these three types, tell me where you fit. I'll tell you which one I fit in just a minute. Type number one, we all hate them. They come to college knowing exactly what they want to do. They get straight through the degree program with no hurdles or troubles or trials whatsoever. They get a 204 on the praxis. Top score is 200. They graduate. They don't get just a job. They get the job in utopian school system with the best students who never misbehave and this gigantic endowment of Orff instruments everywhere. Do you know that student? Are you that student? Because we're going to smack you. No one's that student. Okay, good. That's a really small percentage of the population. My college roommate was honestly that way. He came to college. Life was wonderful. He got straight A's. He got straight out of college into his job that he still has 20-something years later because he loves it. He married the girl that he was dating all through college. So life, just for them, fits in this nice little perfect box. Type number two. We're going to go the other extreme. You come to college not having a clue what you want to do. You just know you kind of like music. And maybe I'll try this and try that. Am I describing some of you more now?
That's me.
Okay. Here's what happens a lot of times. You come to college not knowing what you want to do. Your college says you have to take these classes, so you sign up for those classes. And it's in one or some of those classes that you start to discover, I like this stuff. I know a lot of composers who started in something else, but they took their first theory class and they just gravitated towards it. They love it. And they discover in their first assignment where the theory teacher says you have to write a four-measure melody with a modulation. You get those assignments? They just love that. And that's how they discover their interests and their skills set. And that eventually leads to the career. Did I just describe some of you? Maybe you came to college with less of an idea, but something led you in the right direction? Type number three, this one's me. I came to college with a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do, and I did it. And then God laughed because I'm not doing anything that I said I was going to do when I went to college. In fact, I wound up doing everything I said I would never do. Never say never. Dangerous word. So I want to illustrate all these things by telling you a little bit about my career path. And this all will lead back to these interview questions we're going to get to in a moment. What was point number one?
Bridges.
Bridges. Number two? Never know. Bad dad. Number three?
Chinese
food. Number four? Man plans. God bless. So I have been working with young children since I was a young children. I don't remember a time when I wasn't working with kids. It's just always been something that I gravitated towards. I loved working with them. I felt I was good at it. I grew up in music. You know why? Because my older brother started in piano lessons, and he started bringing home ribbons and trophies and certificates, and we can't have that. So I got into piano lessons so I could bring home ribbons and certificates, which never actually happened. So then he joined band, and he brought home this shiny gold thing that could make obscene noises. And we can't have that. So I joined band, and I got my shiny gold something. Didn't make as obscene noises unless I really tried. But that was kind of my introduction to music. So I grew up being involved in music. I grew up working with kids. But I told myself I would never teach. You know why? Because my piano teacher was mean. And her dog smelled. And I just affiliated all of that with being a music teacher. So it comes time to get into band in high school level, and I think to myself, maybe I could teach a little bit because I loved being in band. That was just, as a high school music student in band, choir, or orchestra, that's what you do. It's your identity. Right now my daughter's a senior, and that's her identity. It's what she does. Did you feel that way when you were in high school? So, I now get to my senior year of high school, and I have to make the logical decision, the real good choice. And we all hate this when we're in high school, because your grandma keeps coming up to you. What are you going to do next year? What are you going to do? Don't tell grandma to shut up. So, what is the logical career choice for someone who has grown up working with children and someone who has grown up in music? Say it. Music education. Wrong. You know why? Because performance is sexy. So I went to college majoring in performance because it was more attractive to the girl I was dating at the time. Remember, the logic of an 18-year-old is not always sound. And also, it's a shorter degree program than education. And the logic of an 18-year-old is get in, get out, get a job. So all this while, I'd been working at summer camps. And after every summer or every year in college, I would come back and work in this camp because I enjoyed working with kids. I get all the way through my undergraduate program. I go straight into my graduate program. You know how I got into my graduate program? Because the conductor at this college where I went to graduate school had been at my undergraduate school to lead a conducting symposium. How many of you are band students? Have you played Salvation's Created? You know that piece? It's got this lovely, very easy horn solo at the very beginning, opening couple measures, and I'm a horn player. So this conductor from Chicago had been down to little Nacogdoches, nowhere, Texas, where I was going to my undergraduate school, and he heard me play Salvation's Created horn solo who knows how many times. And he said, I should go to college here. What was point number one?
Bridges.
Bridges. I got into college or graduate school because not necessarily of how well I did, but really because of the personal connections, the bridges, the people that I knew. Because when I went actually up to audition, the teachers up there are the Chicago Symphony horn section. And I was coming from little Podunk, Texas. I was intimidated. I bombed that audition. The only reason I got into that college is because I knew that person, and he vouched for me. Bridges are so important. They are so important. You never know who in the world is right now in your life that's going to come later. So I get through graduate school, still in performance, having not made that connection, because I wasn't that smart. No comments. When I come back from my master's degree program, I'm still working at the summer camp, and one of the kids who had come to camp, after he left camp, he broke his arm. And mom called me to say, hey, I'm a teacher, my son broke his arm, I need a long-term substitute because the school year is about to start and I don't have a substitute teacher for 3 weeks. Can you sub for me? Like every performance major, I was unemployed. I said, sure. So I started my career as an elementary teacher, 3 weeks as a PE teacher. I loved it. And that's when the light bulb came on that working with children is a very viable career for someone who enjoys working with children. And it took that kind of slap in the face, man plans, God laughs moment for that light bulb to come on in my head. How did I get that job? Bridges, because of the person that I knew. So after that job was finished, she came back. I got online and I found a school still needed a music teacher. It was a private school because I didn't have teaching credentials at the time. And it was in Florida. Don't ever move to Florida. So I taught for a year in Florida, and then at the end I came back to my summer camp job, and while I was teaching that job, here's another funny bridge thing, and I gotta say this slowly to get it right. The mother of the sister of one of my brother's friends from high school. Did you get that? She was an elementary principal, and she heard from him who said that person from that I was looking for a music teaching job at the elementary level. How did I get that job? Bridges. So I get that job teaching elementary school with no experience whatsoever, except for that 1 year in Miami. Let me tell you about that 1 year in Miami. Do you remember point number two?
Yeah.
You never know when you're going to be expected to know something. I got that job in Miami after 2 degrees in performance. No music education class whatsoever. I had 2-year-old kindergarten through 6th grade. Good Lord help us all. I had 2 after-school bands. Let's talk about band. 4th grade, beginning band. 5th and 6th grade, advanced band. It's lovely. The couldn't reach the flute in keys. It was just, it was like she was chasing it the whole time. I think eventually she grew just by trying to reach it. So that was banned. Luckily, my parents loved going to garage sales. So growing up, every time they went to a garage sale, they would find a cheap, nasty little clarinet, bring it home, and I'd teach myself how to play it. Flutes, they found a flute. I taught myself how to play it. Nasty flute tone I have. But still, luckily, I grew up in a house where my parents would buy a $20 instrument, and I'd learn how to play it. So you never know when you're going to be expected to know something. I felt like I did okay with that band simply because of what it was and my experiences. I also had string class. So I had to go to a pawn shop, buy a little violin, teach myself how to honk out Mississippi Top Dog. It was terrible. It was horrible. I also had a choir. Did I tell you I'm an instrumentalist? I'm a horn player, degrees in performance. Choir? What? So we hacked our way through some music. And all the way through that year, you never know when you're going to be expected to know something, parents kept coming up to me because I was their child's music teacher. I was the authority on music. They would ask me questions like, I found this flute in my attic. Is it worth fixing? Can I sell it on eBay? Is my kid ready for voice lessons? Who's the best piano teacher in town? What method book do you recommend, the Faber or the Alfred? It's perfectly okay to say, I don't know, right? But the more you say that, what starts to happen to your reputation? It just completely goes downhill. They start to lose faith in you, and why in the world did this school hire this person? One of the things I like to say to our students is, what's your instrument or voice?
Percussion.
Percussion. He's not getting a Bachelor of Percussion. He's getting a Bachelor of Music. And when you get that job, people expect you not to have just percussion knowledge, but all knowledge. I think you get that in your degree programs because you take your brass, woodwind, percussion, string methods, and hopefully you instrumentalists have to be in choir, and you vocalists get some experiences with instruments because you're getting a music degree, because you never know when you're going to be expected to know something. Are you sick of it yet? All right, so that first year in Miami prepared me for my first year at this little school here. Now, bridges. I start working at this school, and I met Kay Rafe, who was a first grade teacher down the hallway, and her son needed some saxophone lessons, so while I was teaching her son saxophone lessons, I met my wife. Bridges! See, it impacts your personal life as much as your professional life. So we get married, I get a job at a better school system, a little bit more money, we have our first child. I skipped a very important step. Let me back up. Excuse me. Erase that. All right. So while I'm teaching in those first couple years at this public school now, public schools want you to actually have some teaching credentials. So I was working at the school while going to the closest college to where I was living at the time, Dallas Baptist University, where they allowed you to take your music ed courses at night while you're teaching during the daytime. And then they let me use my actual job for student teaching, and that person came out to absorb me student teach. So it worked well with my job. That's how I got my teaching credentials. So then, get married, fast forward again back to this spot where I get this new job, and we have our first child, and a first-year teacher's salary with a new baby is not really substantial to sustain a family. So I tried to find night jobs teaching adjunct at the college level, horn lessons, just so I can try to put food on the family's table. Guess who called me? Dallas Baptist University. Because they knew what I had been doing as a student, and I worked hard as a student, bridges. So I started teaching college at the adjunct level at Dallas Baptist University, where I was previously a student. And then the dean sooner or later called me and said, you're pretty good at this thing. Maybe you should consider getting a doctorate. So rather than keep going through that story, the emphasis of these professional connections, even now that I'm 20-something years past all of that, when I got my job at Austin Peay State University, I learned that the conductor, the orchestra conductor there, his conducting teacher was the same wind ensemble director that I had in my undergraduate school way back then, and I was on a couple of the CDs that he still had on his office. And he used those to demonstrate to his students, and he got to say, hey, there's Eric Ransom playing horn. The person we just hired to replace me, I used to be the music education coordinator at Austin Peay, Michael Chandler, who you met, he was my ORF instructor when I was going through my ORF levels in Dallas, Texas. It is such a professionally small world, and half a country away, I'm still running into people that I knew way back when. part of the reason Michael Chandler got the job is at Austin Peay's because I knew him from 10 years ago when I was going through my ORF levels, and he blew me away as an instructor there. And when I saw his name on our list of applicants here, I said, whoa! So why wouldn't we hire him? It was wonderful. Lots of weird noises, I apologize. So bridges are very, very important. These professional connections that you never, ever know who in your life right now will come back later to either praise you or haunt you. You never know, what was the rest of it? When you're going to be expected to know something. I would not have succeeded through that first year if I didn't have that background knowledge in my head. That first year led to every other year. What was point number three?
Chinese food.
I should have known all of that because I enjoyed working with kids and I enjoyed music. I just never tried the Chinese food to try teaching music. Everything I did was based on a wrong perception that teaching music was this way. One of the things we were talking about at dinner is that a lot of people start the college level saying, I want to be a band director because of what you saw your band directors do when you were a student. And what they do is so impressive. And there's, you use the word prestige, when you stand on the podium. Why are all band directors tall? It's just not right. But they all seem to have this big presence and this voice that just commands presence. And I don't have that. So we see that and we think, I want to be like that person. But what we see, you ever seen pictures of an iceberg, a real iceberg? On top of the water is what we see. How much of the iceberg is that? It's what?
Approximately 1/4.
Yeah, it's about 1/4 or 10%. Most of the iceberg is underwater. You can't see it. That's what sank the Titanic, not this. What we see our teachers do is that top part that's very public, that's very visible. You get on the podium, you conduct the music. The other 90%, everything else that the directors and the teachers do that the students never see, you don't get all that done, you're never going to be successful up here. And so that's what trying Chinese food is all about, to see if you can stomach all of this stuff, if you can manage all of this. Can you keep a grade book? Can you keep an inventory? Can you stand the smell of marching band uniforms on a Saturday morning? All of that will help you figure out if you can actually do all of this. So all of that leads to the stuff that gets into your head that impacts the way you relate to students, that impacts what you believe is important about music education, and all of that impacts the way you answer those questions in the job interviews. And so what I want to do now is spend some time talking to you about some job interview questions. I've got about 25 copies of this, so I'll give them to you and let you pass them out or frame them or make people pay for them or whatever you want to do. It's a front and back sheet of job interview questions. Did you know you need to practice for your job interviews? Oh, yes. Do your applied lessons teachers share with you about your senior recital? You don't just practice the music. What else do you practice getting ready for your senior recital? Everything. Where are you going to stand? How are you going to stand? Vocalists, I don't see how in the world you do what you do, because as a brass player, I'm always hiding behind something. I have to have something in my hands. Vocalists are so very brave, they just go out and stand there and do their thing. So you need to practice all that kind of stuff for the job interviews just as well as you do for your senior recitals. How will you sit? What will you wear? And I think Dr. Chandler talked about some of these things in the job interview skills. So what's coming around is a front and back list of questions. I do not want to go through every single question. Instead, I've highlighted a few. And when we talk about just these few questions, you'll see a couple themes about the interview. Theme number one, they don't really care as much about what you say. They want to know, why did you say it? So as long as you're convinced in your answer, that's fine. Theme number two, every question is not really asking that question. They're asking this question because they want to know something surface level. And you have to figure that out in order to answer the question accurately. Point number three, this is the most important thing, I think, of all of this, is that you don't just want any job. You might feel like it when you're coming straight out of college because you just want a job, give me a job. But you want the right job for you, the right job for which you will be a good fit. How do you know if you're gonna be a good fit? Chinese food. If you have experiences working in suburban schools and rural schools and small schools and gigantic schools, then you'll know how to apply. If you know that the job might be kindergarten through sixth grade, do you have any of those schools in this area? I know that you're very close to Kentucky. A lot of the Kentucky elementary schools are kindergarten through sixth grade, and guess what you do with those sixth graders? Beginning band. Even if you're a vocalist, who gets that job? So you need to know about that kind of thing going into the job and be ready for that kind of question in the interview. So answering these questions is so much more about the right fit for you, and I encourage you all to interview them as much as they are interviewing you. That is your power. You hold the power in the interview. You might feel like you're the product, but they are the product. They need to sell themselves. Why do you want me? Why should I want you? Why do I want to waste my career on your school system? Because I've got a world of opportunities. I've got 49 other states to interview in. What are you wasting my time for? So all that to say, don't be afraid to say no to them. Please say no to them. It's much better to be honest in the interview than to get the job under false pretenses. I once purposely bombed a job interview because of the question they kept asking me. It was at a college, a music education coordinator position, very much like what she does. And will you teach these classes? I could do that. Will you do this? And will you do that? And they just kept asking all these will you do's. And the last one was, oh yeah, well, you will also play with the local symphony orchestra. I said no. And literally, I could feel the energy in the room go boom. And I knew that they were not going to hire me, and I didn't care. I told them, I have two young children, and I'm a husband, and I need to be able to balance my life and be home. And if you want me to be a good teacher, I need to focus on that and not spread myself too thin. I didn't feel like that was an unprofessional answer. But I didn't get the job. I wouldn't have wanted the job if they gave it to me, because I would have gotten that job, spread myself way too thin, and then been looking for another job in a year or two. So that's the reality of it. So a couple questions to highlight. First, you'll notice these come in categories. The first one is all about your fit and your potential longevity. They want to know that you're going to be a good fit in that school, because a job interview process is tiring, and it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of money, and they don't want to hire you knowing that you're just going to be gone in 2 years. Next category is pedagogy and philosophy. In other words, what do you teach, how do you teach it, and why do you teach it? And then the last category is just in general about you. Because in addition to you as a teacher, they want to know about you as a person. Are you going to be a good colleague to the other teachers on this campus? On the back side, questions you might need to think about asking them. Very important part of that process. I will share with you that every interview where I am on the good side of the table, it was one of the most awkward moments when we asked the person, do you have any questions? Just the silence in the room right there that was awkward. It's that same awkwardness. Do you have any questions? Either you don't want this job, you didn't think to do your research, something, you've checked out, you're not going to get this job. That's harsh. So how do you answer that question when they ask, do you have any questions? Let me take a back step. When your teachers ask you, are there any questions, that is code for we're just about out of time. And so when the teachers ask, are there any questions, people start packing up. As a teacher, I've learned don't ever ask that question of your students. Do you have any questions? Because it's a very vague, very broad, pointless question. So don't ask that. It's a terrible question. But for a job interview, be prepared to ask some questions about their school, about their faculty, about their curriculum, about their budget, and so on. So let's go back, please, to questions about your fit and potential longevity, and please look at questions 3 and questions 4. What are they trying to get at in those two questions? Why would they ask you about the aspects of the position that appeal to you most? Shared interest, yes. Do your interests as a teacher match their interests as a school? If you are, I'm going to use elementary again, if you're an ORF person, but they're a Kodai school system, you're not going to be a good fit. If you fully believe in competitive marching band, but they don't, you're not a good fit. If you're a show choir guru, but they are madrigals, you're not a good fit. There's another something about that. What aspects of this position appeal most to you? What do you have to have done in order to be able to answer that question?
Research.
You've got to know that school system. You better have done your research. You need to know if it's an ORF or a Kodai school or a marching band competition or not, or madrigals or show choir. You need to know that. How do you find that information?
Going through their school's website
and dig, dig, dig. Call people you know. Maybe call the music teachers. Find ways to get information about that school system and, frankly, the community. Because if you're a big city person and you move to small town Tennessee, you're not going to be a good fit. You're not going to feel like you're going to spend the rest of your career there. So do that research. Question number four, one of the most dangerous questions that can be asked in an interview. And the way you answer it is all up to you. Question four, how does this campus fit with those that are familiar to your family? And how do you see your family fitting into this city? What can't they ask in an interview?
Are you married?
Are you married? Do you have kids? If you are married, is it a homosexual or heterosexual marriage? There are all kinds of implications of that question. You can volunteer as much information as you want, but don't let them pressure you into answering something that's none of their business. Some schools are very family-driven, family-focused, and they pride themselves on that. And if you're a young single person, or if you're a homosexual person, they're going to oust you. And it's not within their right to do that. And all kinds of political stuff there. But there are ways to answer that question that protect what you want protected, and also you can let them know what you want them to know. I told you just a moment ago when I was asked about doing way too much at that college, I said, look, I have a wife, I have two daughters. I want them to know that my family is important to me and I will not waste myself on my family based on my job. So that kind of stuff is important for you to share as much or as little as you want to share. So what other things are they not allowed to ask? You said family, marriage status, gender preference, political affiliation, religion, ethnicity. Any of that. And don't assume that if you look a particular way, you are a particular ethnicity. They ask all kinds of subtle ways to try to get around that. All up to you. So watch out for those types of questions. The other part about this is that as you are just graduating college, don't feel like you have to answer a particular way just to get the job. Most principals are wise people. They know that very few people get a job straight out of college and keep that job for a really long time because you're trying out the Chinese food. And this is about the time of life that if you're going to get married, that's when you do it. And so you might get married to someone who works there and you'll get your job change. So be honest with them. The other part of this kind of question is, do you have a plan? If you do have a plan, what is that plan? It's okay to say, I want to teach for a couple years and then go to graduate school. I want to teach for a couple years and then move into administration. They want to know that you have a plan. Be honest about whatever that plan might be. I love this job. I want to stay in this job until I retire. Let them know that if that's what you get, certainly. All right. Questions about your pedagogy and philosophy. I highlighted number one. I want you to think about how you would answer question number one. Your strengths and weaknesses. If I could run way over there and still be in range of the microphone, I would do so to illustrate the extremes of how people answer this question. If I ask you about your strengths, start running through a mental list of your strengths. You got it? You got it? Now, do you feel arrogant? Or are you having a hard time coming up with, well, I'm not. I'm good at, no. How are you at that? Are you good at that self-assessment? Are you able to identify your strengths? A lot of people are not. Instead, as musicians, what do? Let's talk about your weaknesses. Start running through that list in your head. And you feel, oh yeah, man, I'm not going to get a job. We are so much better at identifying our weaknesses than we are our strengths, unless we're trumpet players. I'm sorry. I'm a horn player. We have to pick other trumpet players. Do you get where I'm going with this? That we are so much better at criticizing ourselves than we are praising ourselves. When we do praise ourselves, we feel very arrogant, very cocky. I'm sorry, it's not trumpets. I just enjoy picking on trumpets. I've got a whole document full of instrument jokes. What's the difference between a cello and a coffin?
Oh, no.
What?
A coffin has a corpse on the inside.
Oh, no.
I'll keep going. I'm sorry. Ebony's gone. So, how do you answer that question about your strengths and weaknesses without sounding arrogant or without shooting yourself in the foot? Because if you say, well, I'm not too good at organization, record keeping, I'm horrible, classroom management, I have not yet mastered, they're not going to hire you. Why would you? You just gave them three reasons not to, but you didn't say a single good thing about yourself. So how do you answer that question? Any ideas? Throw them out.
Whenever you're talking about your weaknesses, you can talk about how you want to improve.
Love it. How you want to improve. What you're doing to improve. Exactly. What about your strengths? How do you cite your strengths without sounding arrogant? And please, cite your strengths. You're selling yourself.
You said something like, I've learned this over time, and give experiences from where you've learned.
Fabulous. And in doing that, you're connecting what you just said. I used to be weak in this, or maybe I wasn't as strong or as knowledgeable, but here's what I've learned. That's a great way to phrase that. Other suggestions?
How you're going to use your strengths to better enforce your weaknesses.
Exactly. So using this to improve in this area. Also using this to benefit somebody else. A service-minded approach to teaching. I feel like I'm really good at empowering students to learn. I'll share with you one of my things. As a teacher, what I love are the light bulb moments. This is why I love elementary school teaching. When those kindergartners, for the very first time, are able to do something on an ORF instrument, or when they are just able to sing a good song with a good voice, with a good pitch, and all of it. I just love those moments. So I feel like one of my strengths is encouraging and being there for those moments and communicating something very complicated at a level a five-year-old can understand. And when I say it that way, hopefully it's not about me, it's about empowering that student to learn. So some of you, you might be fantastic performers. And it's perfectly okay to say, I'm a great trumpet player. And I can use my skills as a trumpet player to help my students become better at what they do. Great answer. Great answer. There's one more thing about the things that you do or do not do well. I would encourage you, by the way, that question number one up there, practice that answer out loud to people around you, to your roommates, to your spouses, to your whomever. Practice that answer out loud because you don't want to stumble on the answer to that question in the interview. Under next, questions about you in general. Number two, most memorable successes or professional failures. There's an underlying implication of this question. What is it?
How did you recover?
That's part of it. I hadn't thought about that, but she's right. How did you recover?
You actually have experience.
That you actually have experience, that you have tried the Chinese food. You're going to get so sick of these analogies. One of the things that I praise about Austin Peay, and I know that UT Martin does the same thing, because everywhere I go to a professional conference representing Austin Peay, I see UT Martin there. And you guys are always very impressive as groups of students. So when I praise our Austin Peay students for this, I can fit you all in the same bullet. Austin Peay has a lot of outreach programs. We feel that the best way to become a teacher is to actually get your rear end in front of students and teach. Get to the professional conferences, lead workshops, go to the NAFME Hill Day Summit, those types of things. So, what our students gain from that, what you gain from that, is when you graduate, you have this resume that says, look what I did, versus what I hope to do. And principals love that kind of thing. So this question implies that you have experiences. This question also implies that you have had successes and you have had failures. There are two types of motorcycle drivers, those who have crashed and those who will. There are two types of teachers, those who have had real life catastrophic failures in the classroom. If you have not yet had yours, I want to share with you my answer to this question as a model of what I hope you can gain from this kind of experience. And also, this is my humble confession. Remember, I grew up in Texas, very bilingual state. You also need to know that I can be very sarcastic at times, which is not a strength as a teacher. I had this little tiny kindergarten boy come in the middle of the room. His name was Michael. I have a hard time saying Michael without going, Michael. Michael came into my class, Hispanic boy, didn't say a word, and he sat down in the circle. We were all singing our happy little songs, and then Michael just decided to get up, walk around. Hey, Michael, come sit down, please. He'd look at me strange, come sit back down. We'd keep going with the lesson. He'd get up, walk around. Michael, come sit down, please. That kept happening in the course of one classroom, his first time in my class. Some of you see where I'm going with this. He kept doing it. I got mad. I didn't know what to do. So I put him in the timeout room. Corner, not room. So in my classroom, it was almost like this little square. You had to sit down facing the wall. That was timeout. You can argue the philosophy of timeout. This was 20 years ago. It was a different time. No, we did not spank them in Texas schools. But I told them to sit down in timeout. Sit down, face the wall. Very important. And every time I'd come back to teach the class, I'd see Michael turn around and face that wall. So that's when the sarcasm beast came out. And I said, turn around, face that wall. Don't you look at me again, comprendes? And he went, no. Oh. What lesson did I just learn right there in that moment? He didn't speak a word of English. The only word, yes, the only word he understood was comprendes, which means, do you understand?
No.
That was one of my worst moments as a teacher and as a person.
I'm crying.
Yeah. So I said, Michael, lo siento. Venga aquí, por favor. I said, Michael, I'm sorry. Please come sit down right here. Never had a single problem with Michael. It's all about just speaking his language. And that whole speaking the language thing is literal and metaphoric. It's all about speaking the right language to your students. What did I learn from that? Speak the language of your students. Real and hyperbole, whatever the word is for it.
Metaphorically,
thank you. And also, get to know your students, because you never have a clue what they're experiencing. And I yelled at this poor boy before I got to know him. He was a great kid. So that was a huge moment of failure for me as a teacher. I wish I could find Michael now as an adult and say, man, I am so sorry. But there are those who will have these moments. When you have yours, congratulations, you're normal. Just remember that. So you need to be able to answer that question about what have you learned from, or what were your successes and what were your failures? That's another type of question where you can either come across as very ignorant or overly humble, a false sense of humility. Question number 7. I think you all would do a good job of answering this question. Your views on two of the most important issues in music education. I'm going to put you on the spot right now. Group interview. I will either leave today impressed or not impressed by UT Martin's music education students. Oh. What are your views? First, what are the two most pressing issues in music education right now?
I may be wrong, but I think it's like the accessibility, how to make music more appealing to students and how to make music more accessible to students who are not able to get some experience, I think.
Now, do you mean like special education, that kind of make it accessible to them? Or do you mean things like culture and socioeconomic status? That?
Yes.
Okay. That's an excellent point. Is she wrong or is she right? She's right. That's a very present issue. That goes back to this idea of advocacy. Music is so important. How is that going to help little John in the farm run the farm? Why does he need to go support the Nashville Symphony? Great question. How do you answer that? Good question. All right, other issues that are incredibly important in music education.
Funding.
That is always a go-to answer, funding. If ever you get stumped, funding. It's like music history. Whenever you don't know the composer, just guess Beethoven, you're going to be right most of the time. Funding. Don't you dare tell your teachers I said that. Accessibility, funding, what else? How are the marching bands in this part of the state? The high school marching bands?
They're mostly competitive.
They're mostly competitive.
Okay.
Do you know the new national standards?
Yes.
What are they?
Create, connect, respond, and performance.
She gets the prize right there, Evan. So create, perform, connect, respond. I don't see body work in there. I don't see raise this elbow, twist it, do this, get an end mark. I don't see that as part of the national standards. Do you? How does that fit? Is my answer a little jaded? But drum corps are driving the high school marching band world. Is that a national standard? How do you advocate for that as a teacher when you want to spend 6 months on 8.5 minutes of music? And spend thousands of dollars on a prop when your students' tubas are falling apart? Ow! I'm bringing you all down. That's a big issue right now. What are some other big issues?
Support.
Support from whom?
From the community, administration, things like that.
Yeah. What about time in the classroom? Do music educators get equal, more or less than the tested subjects?
Less.
What's the law that was just passed 3 years ago now?
No, that's not
the one that replaced No Child Left Behind.
Oh, ESSA. Every student succeeds at.
Let me go back to Bridges. One of your students, I don't remember who it was, but it was one of the years that the Hill Day Summit team was in Washington, D.C. on the very day that that bill was being discussed before Congress. They left the room, they voted it into law. That's power right there. One of our students was there, one of the UT Martin students was there. Big Bridges. You get to say on your resume, I was there when that was passed into law. So all of these issues, number one, you need to be aware of what the major issues are in music education. Number two, you need to be so aware of it, you have an opinion about it. Let me take a little sidetrack over here to Praxis, because you're about to take Praxis. The New Test versus the Old Test. You've not been in college long enough to recognize the Old Test. It used to be all multiple choice, but now there are three constructive response questions. In other words, essay. You used to just only have to know it well enough to guess on a multiple choice test, but now you have to know it well enough to write about it, and the graders are taught to look for that. In other words, people who don't know what they're writing about, but they're trying to disguise it. Bull. They're taught to look for that. So you need to know what you're writing about very well versus just a multiple choice answer. Your interview questions, you need to know those issues well enough to be able to talk about them and have an opinion about them. That's a hard thing to do. Doesn't mean you have to know all of the issues, just a good enough handful that you can answer a question along those lines. That is a great question, by the way, in a master's degree comprehensive exam at the end of the program. All right, let's look on the other side now in our last 5 or 6 minutes. Faculty and curriculum, these are the questions you get to ask them. Please ask them some questions. Number 6 in the first category, what do you view as a quality music education program? I just went off on my little tangent about marching bands. I support marching bands. I was in drum corps. I love marching bands. My daughter's a drum major. I'm the band dad who lugs the props across the field every Friday and Saturday at the competitions. For the next 3 weeks, we'll be in Chattanooga and Austin Peay and freaking Georgia for marching band competitions. So just know that I do support it. But How does this question pertain to all of that? Does the principal want to see trophies or not? Does the principal, well, it depends on the principal. Some do, some don't, because those trophies cost a lot of money. Just to get 100 band students is two buses from here to there, that's a couple hundred dollars, and then props, and then uniforms, and whoop. So for them, it's all about money. It's all about how will that impact test scores. Are you tired of fighting that advocacy campaign? Do we do everything and use it just to impact test scores? Interview question, there you go. So, what do you view as a music education, as a quality music education program? The big underlying question there is you need to know how are you going to be evaluated. In your college of education, what do you call it here, your education?
Educator prep program.
In your educator prep program, maybe they will teach you about the team model that Tennessee uses. It's how you're evaluated. But you need to learn what does the principal look for in the music program, because you don't have that state standardized test to serve as your score. Do the schools around here use the portfolio model, the portfolio assessment model? Some do, some don't. That's a great question to ask the principal, because you need to know whether or not you're going to have to put together a portfolio or not. And by the way, now that you're doing EdTPA, I want you to look at EdTPA as portfolio preparation. We've been doing EdTPA for 7 years now at Austin Peay, and our students always say when they get their first job that that teacher portfolio is a piece of cake because they did the EdTPA. So link those two. Questions about the relationship of the music program to the school. Question number one, I think, is the most important there. In some schools, particularly at the elementary level, it's a terrible thing to admit that in some campuses you're a babysitter, because the principal wants all the kids to go to music so the real teachers can have their team planning time. I know a middle school once where every eighth grade student had to join choir so that the teachers could all meet and plan during choir time. Horrible advocacy. Don't do that. The principal didn't have a clue the purpose of choir and what that did to the choral program. Yes, it blew up in numbers, but it blew up in many other ways too, because it was filled with 500 kids who didn't want to be there, and that ruined the experience for the 100 who did. So, you need to know how are you going to be viewed, your relationship between yourself and the other teachers and the administrators. Are you going to be supported? Who are the most important people on any school campus?
The secretary.
Custodian. Secretary.
Treasurer.
And the person who handles the money. Yeah. And the lunch cafeteria staff. Good people. General miscellaneous, question number three. Why is the position vacant? That could be a dangerous question. Maybe that's part of the research you need to do before you get there, because the reason that job is open could have a whole lot to do with how you're going to be treated in your first couple years there. A personal story from my experience. One of the substitute teaching jobs I got was a middle school art job in a very conservative town that thought that homosexuality was a sin, and the teacher they hired was a gay man. The middle school students ran him out of town on a rail. They bullied him. They treated him horribly. I was the substitute. Back then, I wasn't married. So what's the natural assumption? He's a gay man, too. They treated me terribly because of that. So you need to know a little bit about why is that job open. If it's a retirement, fine. What if it's a retirement to someone who had been there for 30 years? You're going to spend your entire first year hearing, well, the last teacher did, and well, the last teacher did. Well, the last teacher did. And you need to have the thick skin to say, that's wonderful, I'm so proud of that person, but I'm not him. And it's within your right to do that. So, the rest of these questions, I encourage you to practice. Practice, practice, practice. Get people to ask you these questions. Write these on note cards sometime between now and when you graduate. Once a week or once a day, pull a note card out of a bowl, answer that question out loud. Record yourself answering that question, play it back, and pay very close attention to all of the fillers. How many of you like every like word? Yeah. How many of you say How many of you have a nervous habit, something that you do with your hands all the time? Yeah. So find ways to work through those. Find ways to work through those things. When I do a lot of teaching, you'll find that I almost always have my pencil or my glasses in my hand, just because it's something nice to have in the hands. So something along those lines will help you with that. But practice these things. And with all of these other things that I've worked through, most of you are on the uphill side of this, and that's a great place to be, and I'm envious of that. You're trying Chinese food. You're building those bridges. You are learning all of the things later that you're going to have to know, and you're going to think back to this time in college and think, yeah, I learned that. And then when your plans change, congratulations, you're normal. So thank you very much for listening.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Dr. Branscombe this week as much as I did. We would like to thank the UTM Music Department for making this episode possible. Hashtag Music Ed Love would also like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in, and we hope you'll return for our next episode titled Post Concert Madness, in which we discuss engaging activities that are perfect for the day after your concert. We hope that this week you will be able to sprinkle a little stardust on all of your students, uncover the greatness within a few more humans, and send those stars through the stratosphere. Happy musicking, friends.